Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Kim Barnes. I just want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen on Monday night, i.e. the convention of the Republican Party, which we're going to miss, except it did start during the day today, we're going to be talking about it in the following day. But before we get to our first guest, who has spent a lot of time thinking about what the Republicans are going to be talking about or not talking about, I want to remind you that we begin with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. He is an immigrant. He is a patriot. He spoke truth to power. He lost his job ultimately, or he retired because of the harassment through the Trump administration. But I want his voice ringing in your ears when you decide to exercise the franchise, which you will do in November of 2020, whether it's in person, absentee ballot, or vote by mail, assuming the USPS will still be standing. And with that, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I read My American Prospect religiously. I go to Harold Meyerson all the time or David Dayan all the time. And I said to Harold, okay, so you're like covered the Democratic convention, and I'm sure you're going to be covering the Republican convention. And since we need to sort of talk on Monday afternoon before the real convention happens tonight in, where is it, North Carolina or in the front lawn of the White House? I don't even know where they're doing it anymore. I thought we should at least talk about what you think the agenda will be. And I think we've already gotten a warm-up act because Donald Trump has already spoken in North Carolina after all the states weighed in and nominated him and Vice President Pence. So I'm kind of curious, how do you see the framing of this? And I'm just trying to figure out, what is the message of the Republican Party since Donald Trump is actually the president now? In 2016, he could be very dark and say everything was terrible, but now he's president. How do you say everything is terrible and dark and still be president?
Well, first of all, I think the convention proper convened earlier Monday and then is done by Monday afternoon. They nominated Trump and Pence, both came and spoke. And they, I think, in an act that was more significant than they probably realized, they said, we're not going to have a platform this year. We're just supportive of Trump's America First policy. That's it. And that's almost an act appropriate to a monarchy, to a monarch with absolute power, actually. And Americans revolted in the 1770s against a monarch who only had some power. It was offset by parliament. The issue was they didn't have parliamentary representation either, the colonists. But to say we're for whatever the president, Donald Trump, is for is really kind of a historic break. And it's almost as if the Republicans are saying, we're not a party, as you traditionally have understood the term. We're a cult with a ballot line. It's really very, very pretty amazing. And it reflects the fact that so far, Trump has not really said hardly anything about what he plans to do if he's elected to a second term. What he has done and what I think we'll continue to see over the rest of the televised events, I don't even know if we can call it a convention, properly speaking, is attacks on the Democrats that are preponderantly, you know, fictitious, citing urban disorder, which seems to be basically Portland and Seattle, two cities with the lowest percentage of African Americans, I should point out. It's not African Americans who are really
taking to the streets.
Yeah. And complaints that the Democrats are going to ruin the suburbs. That I think will be the extent of Trump's outreach, the suburban thing. He'll say they're going to raise your taxes, and he will double down, which is why Ben Carson, his HUD secretary, is going to speak. He's going to double down on the fact that the Democrats may push policies to create more affordable housing, parentheses, that means
Blacks.
Minorities,
right.
In the suburbs. I think that's going to be the extent of his outreach, and the rest is going to be going after, Joe Biden is a socialist radical, which I would surprise anyone who's ever had the slightest encounter with Joe Biden, not least Joe Biden himself. Supposedly they're going to have speakers from
Nikki Haley.
I was going to say, they're going to have speakers who were fled Castro's Cuba and Maduro's Venezuela. Now, it's worth pointing out that the avowed socialists who are in the Democratic Party, like Bernie Sanders and AOC, have no affinity for those regimes. If anyone has an affinity for actual communism, not actual communism itself, but, you know, Trump is the guy who cozied up to President Xi in China and to the North Korean regime. Trump's affinity is for authoritarian thugs because he sees his image in them, or vice versa. There's going to be classic red baiting, which I don't think is going to be all that successful. There'll be, the only outreach, I think, is going to be to some of those swing suburban voters on issues of your taxes will go up and African-Americans and Latinos may be coming. I think that's going to be the outreach portion.
Let's go back to where you started, sort of with the no platform, so that makes so much sense, though, Harold.
Yeah.
Because first of all, he doesn't believe in policy. And the lack of consistency with Donald Trump means you can't have a platform because it will change every 30 seconds. You don't want anything that's like committed to paper with a period at the end of it, because Donald Trump will say one thing and 17 seconds he'll say another thing, and then 17 seconds later he'll say another thing. So the concept of a platform is not possible. You know, we had a guest on yesterday who referred to sort of like what's going on as a lava lamp. You know, it's constantly moving and oozing and changing and moving and oozing and changing. That's Donald Trump. And the beauty about a lava lamp is you're not quite sure what color you're looking at. The beauty of a lava lamp is it never really stops sort of changing in front of you. And so in a lot of ways, there's great honesty in not having a platform. It is the most honest thing they have done to date, and I want to applaud them, because guess what? There ain't a platform. It's, you know, whatever frivolous moment that will, you know, utter from his mouth, and that's what the platform is, and they don't want to be committed to anything because he'll shaft them no sooner do they write it down.
Absolutely. And if there were a platform, it would have to say, we believe in being transactional and we believe in being impulsively racist.
Yes.
That's about it. I think that would be about it. They could get it in one or two sentences, because that's what Trump is.
Ken, go on.
What really struck me when you were saying that the Republicans aren't going to have a platform this year is that you said it right after you were talking about how Trump wants to be a monarch and an authoritarian, basically, have absolute power. So he wants to be elected with a mandate to exercise absolute power, whatever he thinks best. And the idea of then having no platform, which gives us a heads up on what he might do next if we do elect him, is absolutely frightening.
Yeah,
is. I think here's what I've always said. There seems to be an interesting love affair in the United States with the monarchy in England. You know, we always, we're kind of like, we're jealous that we didn't have a king and a queen and we didn't have princes. And I said, you know, there is a part of people, especially when they're angry and exhausted, that they want the burden of thinking taken away from them. They want someone else to take care of them. They want someone else to answer everything. They don't want to actually have to think, well, what kind of schools do we want? What kind of roads do we want? What kind of healthcare do we want? Just fix it. And Donald Trump is brilliant at saying, not a problem. I will take care of you. I know it all. I am the best mind, the highest IQ, went to the best schools. And in a lot of ways, he's saying, no, I'm not going to burden you with making decisions because I'll do that for you.
And remember that the one memorable line in his acceptance speech at the Republican convention in 2016 was, I alone can fix it.
Yeah.
That's my point.
And, you know, if you believe that he alone can fix it, then why have a platform anyway? That seems to be, you know, an ironclad guarantee, whatever the issue, he alone can fix it. So why does he need convention delegates even, other than the formality of ratifying his nomination?
I wish people could see you because you're smiling because it's like, so this is such an absurd conversation, but let me tell you why I'm scared. Why I'm scared is, how do you run against nothing? How do you punch? I mean, this is like a punching in a balloon. You punch it on one side, it pops out the other. Because there is nothing there, then you are not even sure whether you hit pay dirt. The only thing you can point to is the 170,000 people who are dead. What you can point to is, you know, the fact that they haven't come up with another plan to help people who are unemployed. The fact you can point to is maybe but you can point to that. But in a lot of ways, he's also running against himself. Well, because he's going to say, all those things that you're pointing to, it's not my fault, it's their fault.
Yeah, that's true. But, there's a lot in what's left over with the actual economy, with the actual state of American health and so on to run against. I mean, when Franklin Roosevelt ran against Herbert Hoover in 1932, which might be the only election where the country was in similarly dire straits to what it's in today, it really didn't matter that Hoover had actual positions. What mattered was everybody understood the country was going down, but hopefully not for the count. And you know, if you look at what the Democrats did in their convention last week, they certainly, you know, highlighted the condition of the nation, and right. Biden and Harris and the Democrats will no doubt continue to do that. And Obama actually, you know, of course, raised the stakes, I think quite rightly, by saying, you know, one of the underlying conditions is a threat to our democracy. So I still think there's plenty to run against. In fact, I mean, look, Trump is such a polarizing president. Most people who vote for Biden, according to the polls, will really be voting against Trump. So despite the fact that, yes, in a certain sense, he's shape-shifting all the time.
All the time.
There's still a there that a majority of Americans in every poll has been taken during his presidency disapprove of.
Well, but I've said this before, and Ken has heard me say this, but I went down in 1986 when I was running for Congress. I was picked as one of the six, you know, best and brightest of that class. And of course, I lost. But anyway, so I'm down there. And I remember saying, this is 1996, that I was so jealous of Republicans. And in a lot of ways, I'm kind of jealous of the no platform. And I said, in 1996, I said, what the Republicans have that Democrats don't have is a very simple bumper sticker. And their bumper sticker consists of one word, no. No taxes, no government, no regulations, no, you know, anything and no services. I mean, it's like the word no, I said, and you know what the beauty of no taxes and no government and no OSHA and no this and no that is that the word no ends the conversation, Harold. You don't have to explain no. No is a sentence in and of itself and it's over. I said, and you know what our damn problem is? We're about yes. Yes, some taxes. Yes, some government. Yes, some public education. Yes. I said, and as soon as you say yes, it gets complicated. And you got to spend time. And people have to think. They have to think about yes. They don't have to think about no. And Donald Trump is no on frickin' steroids.
He is no on frickin' steroids. But this year, he's also no on no cure. And that's a harmful no.
Yes.
And no cure for both, you know, the health of the pandemic and the economy, which is a function of the pandemic. So, you know, you're absolutely right that the Republicans have the benefit of, you know, a much simpler and easily understandable, and you don't have to explain, message, except when no threatens your life and your nation. And he's backed himself into that corner. So let's hope that we've reached the limits of the upside of no, so to speak.
The upside of no. So explain to me why the H, Joni Ernst, agreed to show up and be a keynote speaker. Why did Nikki, what's her name? I've always been told that Nikki thought she might have a future within the Republican Party. I'm not sure that you want to be so tainted as to show up at a convention like this. And Joni Ernst, Iowa is not, they're not happy. I mean, they're unhappy with climate change. They're unhappy with what's happening with agriculture. They're unhappy. And while it is it's kind of a bellwether state. It goes back and forth. Joni's in trouble. And her trouble isn't with her base. Her trouble is going to be getting elected in November. To me, all she did was embrace toxic waste.
And good line. I think where Joni stands out is that all the other Republican senators with tight races are steering clear of the convention. Susan Collins of Maine, Kristen Sinema of Arizona, Tom Tillis in North Carolina. They're not going to be on TV in the evening these weekends. So why Joni Ernst decided this was a good idea is kind of inexplicable. Nikki Haley, I think, is explicable. Haley running for president and thinks that, the first hurdle in running for president in 2024 is getting the Trump voters if you're running in the Republican primaries. And so that's a hurdle she has to clear. And, you know, who knows she'll be running against? Maybe Tucker Carlson, maybe Trump Jr., maybe Tom Cotton, maybe Josh Haley, maybe Marco Rubio. So I think it does make sense politically for her to appear. Joni Ernst, though, I agree with you. I'm completely baffled by why she thinks this will help.
So what I'm hearing from you is this is Nikki's plan. Nikki is going to sort of say to the Lincoln Project, you know me. I mean, I get it. I know he's crazy. But because she showed up during this, Republican convention, she will have made her physical appeal to the Trump base. She'll be winking and nodding and like having, champagne and hors d'oeuvres with the Lincoln Project boys going, just get me there. I mean, I'm the one that can sort of assure the base of what they think they want. And I'm the one that will be able to deliver for you and return the Republican Party back to whatever the Republican Party was before Donald Trump, which was not much anyway. But I'm just wondering if that's the card she's playing.
It could well be. And fanciful though that may seem, I think there's an absolute logic, which is the one you just stated, to her being there.
Do you think it's too fanciful to ask the question about what if the Republican Party is not there or is there in some different incarnation? In other words, if the Lincoln folks actually form another party or don't care about the Trumpers, then what good has Haley done for herself by getting the Trumpers behind her?
Well, the Trumpers are the Republican Party, and they're not going anywhere. So they'll be there in 2024. It's an interesting question about the Never Trumpers and where they will be. These are very experienced people who know that third parties go nowhere in American politics. So I can't imagine they would form another party. So do they do the John Kasich thing? Do they do the Mitt Romney thing? It's not clear. But either way still plunks them down in one of the two political parties. Let's look at this. If Collins is defeated and some of the others are defeated, I mean, one of the groups that is being wiped out is the last vestiges of so-called moderate Republicans. So if they get wiped out electorally and or, just gravitate towards the Democratic Party, then what's left of the Republican Party becomes crazier and more Trumpian and maybe more QAnon-ish even than it is today. It's not going anywhere, but As it shrinks, it probably gets crazier yet.
But does it have any way to get votes that way?
Well, that remains
30% of crazies, then they're never going to win anything.
Well, in some states, crazies can still win statewide elections. And, you know, I mean, there are particular conditions under which a crazy can win a national election. We're suffering under that condition right now. So, in the long term, you know, as it continues to essentially brand itself as the white guy's party, the long-term future of the Republican Party looks fairly suicidal. But, you know, short-term, given the idiocy of the Electoral College and the non-representative nature of the U.S. Senate and things like that, they're not headed for anything resembling imminent extinction.
So let me, before I let you go, what I've been thinking a lot about, Harold, is, so we're worried about how the debates are going to take place. So in a lot of ways, I'm going to be curious about this Republican convention because I'm going to see how they frame it. I'm going to see what the attack lines are, because you're going to know that there's going to be a variation on that theme during the debates. But how do you debate a consistent liar? How do you debate? I mean, you can't keep saying that's not true for 45 minutes. I mean, John, how many times do you say that is fabrication? That is a lie. I mean, he's going to need 5,000 words that mean lie. But, you know, but instead of using the word over and over again, how do you debate someone who has no relationship with the truth?
That is a damn good question. And I think a lot of Joe Biden's top campaign people have been asking themselves that question for months now, and hopefully they've come up with some reasonable answers. One strategy would be for Biden to say, look, I'm going to focus on the real America and what's actually happening and not pay attention to that nonsense. And to a point that works, and to a point it doesn't work. And there's a line there, and I don't know where that line falls on the continuum of what helps you.
Is there something Biden could do to get the moderators of the debate, the media people, to at least somehow allow him to do that and prevent Trump from being totally off the truth rails?
Well, historically, and I'm sure this year as well, both candidates have to agree on a particular moderator.
Right.
I think that is the only way Biden can have that kind of influence, but we haven't seen this raised as an issue yet. But I'm having trouble imagining who it is that the Biden people and the Trump people could actually.
I know. Boris Johnson. I think Boris Johnson should moderate the debate. It would be very, very. I'm being funny, but I'm kind of not being funny a lot of ways because he thinks Donald Trump has this affinity for Boris Johnson, but Boris Johnson is actually someone who has respect for policy, respect for governing, and he's also survived COVID. So there's a reality check on Boris that I think is valuable, and it would be difficult for Donald Trump to reject Boris because he sort of takes claims him, and at the same time I think Biden kind of knows that, at least Boris understands that policy matters and that there's this concept of governing. It would blow everybody away, but that would be someone I would look to because there's nobody else on the planet, I'm thinking at this point, especially with, journalistic credentials, that I can see either one of them agreeing on.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought about that until right now, but it is very hard to come up with somebody that both candidates could agree upon. I mean, partly just because, American journalism is polarized into the real and the fake. And the fake is the Fox people and their ilk. And so, and given that, you could sort of imagine maybe Mike Wallace as the one actual working journalist at Fox.
Right.
Who knows?
Who knows? So last but not least, so as we're looking at all this going forward, the question is, you don't want Biden to sort of address every lie, but we're already seeing this with Kamala Harris, all the sort of misinformation and suggesting that she's really not from here and she really can't run for president. And you don't want to leave certain things on the table. So there is this idea that Kamala has to respond. And my concern about Biden is, does Biden have to respond? Because what Donald Trump is great at doing is he's really good at repeating lies over and over and over again and threading the lies into every conversation. He'll have a press conference on COVID-19 and he'll start.
Yeah.
Lie about something else.
Yeah, well, first of all, by the way, I said Mike Wallace, I meant Chris Wallace. I'm dating myself.
Wrong. Yeah, I was
Wallace.
Wondering about
not
that.
Not George Wallace either, or Henry Wallace. But the in terms of how much do you have to debunk, you know, we saw what they did with John Kerry and the Swift boats. So yes, Kamala is kind of an unknown quantity, and I think she needs to do that. It's harder to redefine Biden. He's been around forever. People know him. So there's a greater burden falling on the Democrats to set the record straight on Kamala. They have to do some of that on Biden, but Biden is much more of a known quantity and therefore harder for Trump to characterize.
Well, would it be a adequate response for Biden to say something almost exactly like that? Look, you all know me. I've been around for 100 years and I've never been... anything remotely close to left wing.
Well, he needs to say that, but not obsessively, because
no, that's what I mean.
Part of what you just said, Ken, which is you all know me.
Yeah.
Have we lost Arnie?
She looks like she's still there, but it's hard to tell. And I have us down there for 1 minute left anyway. Do you, Harold, want to say anything in conclusion, including, by the way, whether you think there's any parallels between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party? Because when you were talking about the right-wing Trumpers and being left as the only one still in the Republican Party, what do you think it's the same situation for the Bernie Democrats and the Biden Democrats? Or is there more likelihood that they have a good marriage?
Well, I mean, the Bernie Democrats have really no place to go except the Democratic Party, unlike the anti-Trump Republicans who can do the Kasich route and go to the That's Democrats right. this year. So
they
so
still have a choice.
I think the Democratic Party stays together. The Republican Party has already eroded, and we'll continue to see. We'll see if this continues to happen.
So I need to let you go, Harold Morrison. I apologize. I was kicked off Zoom at least 3 times during the course of this interview. So please, please, please. But this is the technological challenges that everybody is facing. So yes. I don't feel bad when I watch MSNBC and CNN having the same thing. So I'm thinking, okay, we're all in this boat together. But yeah. If I have to be in a boat, I want to be in a boat with Harold Morrison. So thank you so much.
My pleasure as always, Arnie. Good luck with Zoom.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye. All right. Thank you so much. Harold Morrison writes for the American Prospect. It is prospect.org. We will, I'm sure, grab him again next week so he can do the evaluation of what happened during the Republican convention. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
Read an interview with a young actress, said she wasn't a feminist. This outspoken actress was on the A-list. Sorry, but I just can't resist. What on earth are you picturing? Castrating men while wearing sensible shoes? You must not know what feminism means, cause a feminist is you. You're a feminist. Sorry, babe, but you're a feminist. I just think you don't even get the gist if you say you're not a feminist. Millennial women were truly happy for you. Feel empowered, and that was the goal, it's true. So many of your rights are guaranteed today that you can't imagine things were ever any other way. I'm so glad you don't have to deal with this much crap, but to give the feminists who came before you a bad rap, I mean, dude, they even gave you your free pap. So why don't you just shut your yap? Only about this, though. Say anything you want about anything else, all your opinions, and don't let anyone tell you can't, because you're a feminist. Yeah, babe, you're a feminist. Just take a look at the checklist. You like voting? You like driving? You're a feminist.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder that we Zoom on Monday afternoon, but this is a good interview because I don't have to worry about something happening tonight that might undermine the sort of the content and the quality of the interview. So as many of you know, one of my absolute favorite places right now has been theconversation.com. I recommend that if you are a professor and you have something to say, search out theconversation.com and write about it. If you are interested in lots of really fascinating topics and you're not getting satisfied in your media outlets or your newspapers because they don't focus on your topic, you might actually find it being discussed at theconversation.com. So I am like the happiest camper because I can't do politics 24/7. And yet to some extent, almost everything is politics. So even this conversation will sort of thread into that. So I'm at theconversation.com and I see this article. In the work from home battle for space, women are the reluctant nomads. And I went, ooh, this is an intriguing concept. And I decided I needed to not only read the article, but I had to reach out to the author of that article. We are being joined by an assistant professor of media and communication studies at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. Elizabeth Patton is the professor of these media and communications and the author of this article. She conducts research and writes about historical representations of gender and race in television and film, representations of urbanism and suburbanism in popular culture, and the impact of communication technologies on space and place. Ooh, I love you, Liz. And the other thing that I thought was also fascinating, because I then Googled your name, is that you have a book out entitled Easy Living, The Rise of the Home Office. So you have spent a lot of time sort of looking at space and communications and how we relate to space. And I thought this would be a perfect time since we're all now sort of working from home and home has now changed the concept as a place where we sleep and feed our families. It has now become the workplace, the school place, the health place, the feeding place. It's like ridiculous what this place has become. So I thought this is a totally appropriate time to ask you to join us. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, I am too. And so I also used to teach communications. I used to teach mass communications. And I remember talking to my students, this is way back in the actually late 1990s. And I reminded them about how we learned information when we were home. And historically, it was print, okay? And then after print, the big thing that happened was radio. And then radio happened, we would all sit around the radio and we would listen to the radio. And then guess what? Radios got sort of inexpensive and you could have a radio in the kids' room and then a radio in the living room so that, you know, we all had our own little radio. And then came the TV and then we all sat in front of the TV and it was black and white. It was so exciting. We only had five or six stations that we all sort of watched together. And then guess what? The TV got cheaper and it got in color and then you could have a TV set up in your room and you could have a radio up in your room. And so what was changing, as I told my students, is that information came into the house in very different ways. And where historically information came, it came so that we were all together when we would read the paper or listen to the radio or watch the TV. And then what happened was it became something that was specific to me. It would isolate me. We didn't need to do it as a family. And information now came in a million different ways that we couldn't even envision. And now we're looking at a place where not only is information coming in, but they're telling us, hey, we don't even need to go to work anymore. We can just stay home and all the information and all the work and all the obligation can actually happen at your dining room table. And I'm thinking, is this like a good thing or is this a bad thing? So as I go back to my mass communications course, I love what you talk about because you look at the idea of working from home as something that has historically kind of been there, but for women, it's never really been there. And that's because I think the nature of how women are perceived when it comes to the home, and they aren't perceived as doing work despite the fact that they do all the work.
Yes, yes. And so that's what I was interested in. So I found myself early on, I was working through my graduate work, graduate courses for my doctoral program. And as I was working through the courses, I was just struck by the fact that here I was, you know, working at weird times. I had just had a baby. And so I was a little overwhelmed with that. And I'm trying to find a space in our house. to work in our apartment at the time in New York City. And I'm trying to figure this out. And at the same time, I'm overwhelmed. So I was watching a lot of HGTV. So I'm a little embarrassed by this, but I was pretty much, I was a super fan. And I was watching it just to kind of decompress. And like, and so I started noticing just over and over again, just conversations that, you know, when couples, like you think of House Hunters and couples are looking at houses and over again, or these renovation shows. And they're like, well, where's the home office going to be? And I also, I noticed that the conversation tended to be dominated by men, and not to say that women weren't asking for home offices, but they tend to be, if you had a typical heterosexual couple, that the conversation was more about the men having this particular space. And then for women, it was more like hobby spaces or, okay, well, I'll take the basement, or do you know what I mean? Some other space, if the basement wasn't going to be a man cave, I can go on and on. But anyway, so I started to think about that. And at first I was really interested in the idea of privacy. And so when I first went into it, I was really looking at like, why am I working in my bedroom? What is the meaning of privacy in the home? Why do we see the home? Like you said, does it matter, right? What type of work is done in a home? And then also, you know, I'm obviously, and to defend my partner, you know, he's very involved. He was very involved in child raising, still is. But, you know, I still found myself still in terms of, I would say the split, that I was still felt that, you know, I was doing a lot of that, you know, care, like a labor that's not necessarily recognized. And so like that kind of caregiving labor. And so I found myself thinking about that and realizing that for me, there weren't clear demarcations in terms of when I was maybe cleaning or taking care of a baby, but then at the same time, I was trying to read something and type and work. I don't know if that makes sense. And so—
No, it makes total sense. And that's what I love about, and just let everyone know, there was an article called The New Republic where you're being interviewed almost exclusively. And the title of the article was "Remote Work Won't Save Us. The home office was never designed to give workers more freedom. The pandemic has only made it worse." And yet, as I'm reading the article, it made it worse for women.
Yes.
That's what
yes.
made it worse. We keep talking about this as being a woman's recession. We're so screwed on so many levels. And even from the work at home, it is the woman, as again, the nomad that you describe in your conversation piece, and the idea that it won't save us, who it really won't save are females.
Right. And so I found that, of course, this book is about class, and inadvertently or indirectly, I should say, it's also about race, because this is about, you know, privilege in terms of who's able to work at home. But it always came down to gender and this kind of intersections of gender and class. And what I found was I couldn't escape that, even when I was starting to do archival research, that even the way office products and homes and home design, how it was marketed to men versus women was entirely different. And then so for men, what I found was a history that's connected to the study, the library, a longer history of acceptable for men to work at home, and I'm sure men should work at home. Or it could be like a hybrid space in terms of like leisure, a place to like, you know, escape the feminine influences of a home. If you think about the Victorian era, you know, a place to smoke your cigar and read your newspaper. But for women, there really weren't spaces like that. Now, women did have parlors. There were spaces that, you know, sitting rooms, but not a space dedicated to work. And so what I found was interesting as I traced the history of both the home office and like the history of these rooms, right, that became what we call the modern day home office, when we started using that terminology, but also tracing the technology, the telephone, the typewriter. And as you said, like these, even, you know, indirectly, the radios involved, TV for sure. And then we get to the laptop, that, well, the personal computer, and then the laptop, then you see this history of also trying to figure out, well, these companies, well, we want to expand our markets, because that's what companies do in capitalism, right? But they're trying to figure out how do they do this, right? And so what I found was interesting, there was always a tension between woman as homemaker, home manager, housewife, right? And then this idea that you could contribute to the economy, or you could contribute to your household. And then by the like second wave feminism, you could have a career. But for women, this false narrative work-life balance was never really realized. And that's the tension I was interested in.
So I'm laughing. So back in the 1980s, I was a state representative, and I'm thinking about men versus the women. The men would play poker two or three times a week. And the poker would be, they would either go to a club or they would have that leisure room in a house, and they would have their cigars in the bar. But that's where business took place. There wasn't the equivalent for women. We didn't have like a poker game. We didn't have a place to smoke a cigar. We didn't like cigars, you know? And it was like so interesting, because even within the house, even within clubs, the understanding was that they would have a separate space, and that separate space would combine business and leisure, and that men were expected to do that. There was never that for women. Do you know where I ran for governor in Congress. Do you know where all my plaques were in my house before I divorced my first husband? All my plaques from having, I can be honest, all my plaques were in the laundry room.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Because guess what? That was my room. That was my room. Nobody else folded clothes. Nobody else washed clothes. Who was in there all the time? And you know what? I needed those plaques. Because as I was sitting there folding clothes, I needed to know, wow, I got that award. Wow, I got that award. One, it would keep me sort of like, I would bring my ego down, because I'd be sitting there doing the laundry. But at the same time, that was my space. Nobody else went in there, and I had no other space to put the plaques. So I put them in the laundry room. But that really speaks volumes about why we're nomads. We have to fit between the interstices of the cracks, and men are given the blocks, and we're like the cement that holds it together, but there's not much space there.
Right. And that's what I thought was also interesting, that even children take away space, right? And so this idea, like, so I talk about in the book this, you know, as children, you know, become this like special group, right? And I'm not saying that, you know, children should go out and work at 13, but the point is that children started having their own spaces, right? And so even they're competing. So even women are competing with their children, right, in terms of space. And that's what I was trying to get at the conversation article. I got a little pushback from people. Their person said, I'm trying to remember what the comment was. I think it was on Twitter, but, you know, like, I'm doing this to myself. And I said, well, you know, it's 1,100 words, so I can't really explain all the history of how I got there. But to the point is that, you know, I'm married to someone who before worked at home, right? And so it was telecommuting. And so I wasn't competing, you know, for space in that sense, because I didn't need it. And now that you said that the home has come to space where now my son's going to school here, like everything is involved, right? And so now I find myself as a nomad. So yes, I totally appreciate the irony of that I wrote this book and I'm the one that's like, you know, sitting around and can't figure out where to work. And so, but I think why I wrote the article and what I was trying to get across, and it definitely seems like you get it, is that what I was trying to say is that these are structural issues, like that the house, like we already have these issues in terms of inequality for women, right? And sexism in the workplace. We see how this plays out, you know, homes, workplace in our society. But what I found interesting is that the home, which we've always known, right, that this was, you know, a microcosm of this issue, right? We've always known this about the home, especially if you look at the history of housework, and plenty of people have written about this. But when I started to think about market labor in the home, I really think that revealed how the house itself reveals the structural inequalities in terms of women, work, and these relationships are still persistent, right? And so this is what I was trying to get at. And yes, there are places where, you know, there are homes where not every home of the woman is struggling for space, because, you know, different homes are composed in different ways, right? But I was trying to get at an overall point, and I did get a lot of positive feedback from, you know, on social media, where people say, yeah, that is my situation. I totally know what you're talking about, right?
Well, you know,
real.
But the other thing is that women have always been working. We just haven't been valued for the work we do.
Exactly, exactly.
And so I remember telling people, it's like, so if I'm doing the canning of the vegetables, and I'm doing the cooking, and I'm doing the freezing, and I'm putting it into the root cellar, I hate to break it to you, but that's how you survive. You know, right. it's lovely that he goes to work, but all the things I'm doing means you get up in the morning and you still have a pulse. It's like,
right. Exactly. And that's what I think
it's never valued, Liz.
Right. And that's what I was interested in, and how we go from the homestead in this idea where if you know, we go back a few hundred years, that women's work was valued in terms of as a family economy, right? And we're all working, you know, in this homestead, right. And different, and I'm talking about, you know, in terms of the U.S. and Western societies. However, if you look forward, you know, as we track time and we look forward in history, we see, especially around the Victorian period, where we get to separation and then women's work, you know, becomes devalued, right? And is something that's frowned upon or something that's associated with the working class, right? In labor, which I also talk about that, and its dependence on the working class and the service economy, that you get this, you know, where all of a sudden, like you said, women have been working all along in the home. And that's one of the other arguments I was trying to make in the book, and these companies recognize this, and that's why the companies exploit it. When I say companies, these, you know, telecommunication, technology companies, typewriter companies, they understood this. And so this is why they marketed these products to women and say, okay, you may not be working in quotes, what they mean by market labor, and you know, and you're married now, so you're no longer, you know, working as a secretary, but you can take these skills and use these products to manage your home, right? And so this was this idea, like, well, you can manage your home and you can use these skills and these products to make your home, you know, more efficient. And basically this idea, which I thought was interesting, this thread that I found through all of these marketing advertising tactics was to appeal to women as managers, right? As married middle-class women as managers. And specifically white women, you know, that's the history, and we have to own that. But going, you know, going forward, and so this is why we are where we are now. And that was the argument that I was trying to make.
I haven't thought about this in a long time, but when cell phones were just coming out, and they were talking about how wonderful it was. And you see this mother going to the beach, picking up her kids to take them to the ocean. And the great thing was she didn't have to leave work. She could still bond with her children. They could play in the sand. They could be swimming in the ocean, and she could still be connected. And wasn't this a gift? And I remember hating that commercial. I just hated that commercial. Little did I know that that commercial would dictate how exactly we live now, only on steroids. But I knew from the beginning, when I first saw them marketing that crap, that this was not a good news story, but a bad news story. And now, because of the pandemic, Liz, we are living that story on steroids, because it is what is really scary for me is that because there are so many competing needs happening at home, I want to be honest. You and I both know our needs are going to be the last ones met.
Yes.
It's going to be, he's going to be the first one to have a separate space. Our kids, because they're going to have to study and they're going to have to, you know, use whatever the internet service is, they're going to have to do it. We're going to have to be supportive of them. And someone said to me the other day, you know, Arnie, I just got this email from you at 3:30 in the morning. Well, you know, I hate to break it to you, but I suspect that that'll be the case for lots of women I know. It'll be at 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning that they finally get the kitchen table, or they get the room and they get the space. And I think that that is going to have real emotional issues for women going forward, because it is going to overwhelm them in a way that we've always known it was tough, but it seems to be now even tougher.
Yes. Yes. And I just had a Zoom meeting with some colleagues, and we were talking about that in trying to figure out how to address this at the university level. But what we're finding is, at least, you know, within the university, that women are really suffering the consequences in terms of faculty of getting their work done, and, you know, the ability to do research and like you said, finding a space to work, right? And also, because the kids are home now, at least in this area, but in most metropolitan areas, because of either hybrid or online formats for the fall, we're stuck, right? So women are, and so when we, my university, when they did, you know, they asked, like, put out a survey, they wanted input from the faculty, I know you wouldn't be surprised, but the majority of the people that spoke up were women. right? In terms of that this was going to have a negative effect on their careers. And I have friends that are outside of, you know, that are in the corporate or other nonprofits, and they're all reporting the same thing, that their careers are being derailed because of the pandemic. And yes, lots of people lost their jobs, but for people who have kept their jobs, for women particularly, this double burden of, you know, having to deal with childcare, to deal with the household, all this kind of invisible labor that women do, and also trying to manage to, you know, to do their work and find a place, right, and find a quiet place and be able to have enough, you know, bandwidth and not sharing a bandwidth.
So here's your conversation.
This all adds up.
Right. So your conversation article par deux is that I'm thinking about it. So you have a lot of women who have to go into the workplace. They can't not go in. They're in the service industry. They're in the nursing home industry. They're in the whatever. And they have to physically show up. But of course, they also have kids who are home because they can't be they can't go to school. So they're facing this real dilemma of how do I physically show up because I have to, and what do I do with my children? And then you have the people who can, the luxury, I'll put that in quotes, of being able to work from home, and their spouse is able to work from home, and their kids are going to be home. And yet even in that home setting, you're still at the back of the bus.
Yes, yes.
So you're either going into the workplace and you're screwed, or you're at home and you're still at the back of the bus, and you have to sort of figure out how to find the time to fit you in. So here's my question. How do we fix that?
We need to fix this on a structural level. And so what I mean by that is that companies, right, schools, companies, government, both local and federal, need to step in my opinion, need to step in and deal with this. Because I think this is what the problem is this pandemic has shown that, you know, in terms of our U.S. and American ideas about individualism, it's falling on people. Right? And individual people. And it's always fell on women. And so what's happening is there's no support, right? And so like you said, if you have to go to work, you have to make these choices, right? Or if you're working from home, but you still have to, you know, make these choices between getting my work done or taking care of my family, when in reality, that these, regardless of the pandemic, what I think the pandemic has shown that these issues haven't went away, that things like childcare, right? Yeah. That flexible schedules, to rethinking what it means to be productive in terms of work, you know, hours. These are all issues that we need to solve, from healthcare, for elderly care. It's not just kids, like people who are caregivers to, you know, to their parents. Like there's many different things that we need to think about and really think about in our society. And we can see that why it broke down is because we don't have those safety nets. We don't have the structure in place.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So we're talking about whether we're going to get that $600 additional unemployment benefit. Mm-hmm. You know, what are they going to do for all the unemployed? I think we need to sort of start creating something along the family benefit. And that in a lot of ways, you know, we hear a lot of African Americans talking about reparations. I think women need to start talking about a variation on the reparations theme, because we have never also been compensated for what we do. And I mean, and I'm saying, in a lot of ways, Liz, it's kind of like reparations for African Americans is a much bigger and much deeper and much historically horrific situation, because you begin, I love the book, The Color of Law, which talks about how through policy, we have actually created all these elements of inequality.
Yes.
But inequality also is a story for women as well. And so as we begin to look at what Andrew Yang said, remember how Andrew Yang wanted to have that sort of that stipend? Well, I think that stipend is a good idea, but I think it should actually almost be reframed. And then instead of it just sort of being there, it sort of understands that this is the compensation that recognizes what women have always done, but no one has ever put a dollar value to it. But yet that value is, you know, priceless.
Yes. And we don't have time to talk about, but there's for people interested, there's a lot of feminist scholars who've talked about that, especially beginning in the 60s and 70s, of women being compensated for housework. Right. And so,
right, exactly.
You know, in addition, you could compensate women by paying them equally at the job. How about
yes, that's
it. On the dollar.
Yes,
yeah, that
but also in terms of compensation, I'm wondering, you know, African Americans are descended from other African Americans, but how do we compensate my mother for busting her chops working at an income producing job and then coming home and having to get the groceries and cook dinner and all the other stuff that she had to do for us when the us was just my brother and I? So how do we compensate my mother by giving reparations to the boys?
Well, and I think, Liz, what we have to talk about is invisible work.
Yes.
And that our goal moving forward is to make what is invisible visible.
Yeah.
And that, in, to a large extent, the whole story of Black Lives Matter is that they've known what's been happening to them. And then all of a sudden we get to see it on a cell phone. It was always visible, but we didn't see it.
Yes. Okay? And as an African-American woman, yes, I know that Black Lives Matter as a Black woman, but women, right, in terms of like this invisibility, right? And so that's why I do think it's important to think about intersectionality, and how, class, race, and gender intersect in our world. Again, we don't have enough time to talk about it, but I think that, like you said, that housework, the labor, the invisible labor that's done in the home does need to be visible.
And on that note,
be compensated.
In the work from home battle for space, women are, I love this word, the reluctant nomads. If you go to theconversation.com or you go to my Facebook page, you will find it. We've been chatting with Elizabeth Patton. She is an assistant professor of media and communication studies at the University of Maryland. Thank you so much for this. And I'm calling all my girlfriends. Start figuring this out. I want some solutions here. Thank you.
I'm all for it. Thank you.
All right, ciao.
Thank Bye-bye. You for having me.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Oh, tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere.